Okay, welcome everybody to our latest episode of I Need to Effing Talk to You podcast. It's the second of our interview podcasts, when we have a special guest who's joining us today to chat about all things to do with acting, improv, and how wonderful it is to work with Ken and I believe, was the briefing that we gave to our guest. My name is Russell Stratton, and my co-host Ken Cameron.
Hello, everyone. Nice to effing be with you today. It's, as usual, an effing pleasure to be talking to you, because I need to effing talk to you. And today, we need to effing talk to Nicole Zylstra, one of the actors, improvisers that we use with our program, the I Need to Effing Talk to You program. But more importantly, one of my longest friends in Canada, who I've known for more decades than I'd like to count. I first met Nicole Zylstra when we were students together doing our undergraduate degree in Montreal at McGill University. We were both in the English program, but more specifically, we were specializing in theater. And it was really just our excuse to get a credible degree and still be drama nerds. And so I met Nicole there. She was technically a year behind me, even though she took a gap year. So I think we were more or less of the same age. I met Nicole, who was then a strikingly eccentric Joni Mitchell lookalike, and who immediately rose to prominence in our drama department by getting all of the best roles. And we took a number of classes together. And in one of those classes, we were studying the 19th century classic play, La Dame aux Camélias, was a novel, and then it was turned into a play called Camille. We did a modern adaptation of it, which was a little bit around a play around gender and a play on gender. And we ended up being cast in repertory as the male lead. So I got to play it one night, and Nicole got to play it another night. And so we were on stage, but I don't think we were ever acting together simultaneously. But that was certainly quite the challenge for all of the other actors who had to try to keep up with two very different paced actors and two very different personalities. But that was my first introduction to Nicole Zylstra. And since then, I have watched Nicole's career blossom as an actor of stage, as a playwright. And I later watched her move to Calgary, which is where I also moved to. She came along a year later than me and did the same master's degree at the University of Calgary. Started as the designer, because she is a fabulous designer and artist, but quickly switched into directing. And then as we both graduated, I kind of watched her career grow, and I watched her do a number of different plays and stage adaptations. I think one of my favorite was the aforementioned play Camille, which you did in a roller skating derby, and which you redubbed as Camille on Wheels. Yes. You also did a musical called was called Hey Jesus or Say Jesus?
Oh Jesus! Oh Jesus! Exclamation point! A love
oh
story.
Jesus! Exclamation mark! Which was a love story, right? Which was a little riff on the Jesus Christ Superstar with a little bit of a homoerotic undertones. And what I always admired about your work, Nicole, as a playwright, was that you were able to take pop culture and make it into something incredibly meaningful and present for your audiences. I also then watched your career blossom into some of your own more original scripts and more autobiographical scripts. You became a hit on the fringe circuit. And I think the quote that I loved was that it's like listening to a librarian lost in the stacks while being interviewed on CBC Radio, was the quote that I think was on your fringe posters, which I'm completely bastardizing that quote. Go ahead, Nicole. What was the actual quote?
I think
quote?
It was as if a stand-up comic got lost in the library stacks.
Nice segue. Because the latest incarnation of Nicole's career that I've simply loved is that you've been working in the world of improv with the Kinkonauts, one of the two great Calgary-based improv companies. And that's where we reconnected again around this work with our colleague Russell. So that's my long-winded, rambling introduction of Nicole Zylstra. I've completely omitted the film and television that you've done, particularly the German language filmed in Alberta productions that you've done. I'll leave that all to you, because I'm still completely flummoxed by that particular niche that you fell into. Tell me, fill in some of the gaps, Nicole. What else have I missed out in your bio?
You said two great improv companies in Calgary, but there are three. Everyone knows the Loose Moose, which I have appeared on stage at the Loose Moose from time to time. The other is Dirty Laundry, Calgary's longest running improvised soap opera now. And it's going to be when the world comes back, it's going to be in its like 22nd season or something. So I was in the original season. I started as a director and then the season two moved to performing and I stayed with them for 16 years until the Kinkanauts, they overlapped with the Kinkanauts for a while. And then at some point I got overwhelmed and I transitioned full time to the Kinkanauts where I was an improv performer, teacher, coach and facilitator for business. So I covered all the bases.
And was that your introduction to improvisation was at the Dirty Laundry Improvised Soap Operas? Was that the first time you became an improviser?
My intro to improv, because as Ken very well knows, when we were at McGill, I did not do improv. I actually knew some improvisers and hung out with some improv people, but I never went that way until I moved to Calgary. And I was living with my boyfriend, Len, at the time, Len Stanga. And he was an improviser with a company called Shadow Productions that did semi-improvised murder mysteries. And one day they had an actress get sick on them. And Len got a call from Kathy, head of Shadow Productions, saying, Len, your girlfriend, she does like acting and stuff, right? Can she get in the van? We're going to Innisfail. We leave in an hour. And that was my introduction to improv. I hopped in an unmarked van with some strangers and we drove to Innisfail and I worked with some incredibly talented people. And I was just flabbergasted. And apparently I did okay because then I stayed with that company for about 15 years and spent at least 3 years writing murder mysteries for them as well.
Nicole, could you give us a little overview of how you would describe improv? Because I know that not all of our listeners are well-versed in the world of theatre acting and comedy. So how would you describe improv to the layperson?
That is a great question. What we do with the Kinkanauts, essentially, is long-form improv. There's two types of improv. And essentially, improv is making stuff up. We make stuff up in the moment. And in short form improv, like you might see the Loose Moose, usually that is centered around games that are embedded in scenes or scenes that are embedded in games. And in long form improv, we do games embedded in scenes. So everything that we do, it's just like you were going to see a play. We write and direct and produce and act the play, but in real time, we make it up on the spot. So a lot of what I was doing was narrative improv. So we have different genres. Like we would do Shakespeare, Chekhov, musical. I'm part of the musical team. So we'll make up a Broadway style musical, including we have an accompanist playing along with us, and we'll create a play with lead characters and subplots and interweaving plots that all come together at the end. So it's just like watching a TV show or a movie, but we are making it all up on the spot.
And the short-term improv is what? More like watching a sketch comedy show where there's little bite-sized chunks?
That's right. Short form is like what most people will have seen, Whose Line Is It Anyway, on TV. So that's short form for sure.
You mentioned that there's games, scenes embedded with games, or in the long form, it's games embedded within scenes. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the role that game plays in improvisation?
Games are really important in improvisation, and that's sort of how we frame a lot of our language. So, for instance, in short form, you'll be introduced to a game. We're going to play this game, whatever it is, the hat game, where people have to take a hat from the other person. But they build sort of a framework of a scene to make the game more interesting. And for long, so the games are really overt in long form. The games are played within the scene. So the important thing is the character relationships and the story that you're telling. But within each scene, there is usually one or two games that you learn to identify. And that sort of helps to move the plot along and helps to develop the characters. So the games are more in service of the scene. And in short form, the scene is in service of the game.
Right. And in the long form, you might, as a viewer, we might not even know the game is, we might not even see the game. We might not know the game is there. It's just a tool that you're using to structure the scene or the conversation between the two actors.
Absolutely. Yes. Some games might involve status, who's got the higher status and how those two characters interact because of that. Or some games might just involve heightening elements of what's already happening. Or you're taking one simple thing and putting it in a different context so that it becomes ridiculous. There's a great example of one of the sort of improv training games that we play sometimes with people to introduce them to this concept of mapping. It's called, is where you take one situation, put it in a different. So you get two improvisers on stage and get them to improvise a scene about somebody leaving for college, leaving their parents, leaving their house for college, and that sort of farewell scene. You get them to play out that scene. And then you get them to replay it again. So it's the same thing. It's a tender farewell scene, but it's set like in a prison on the release date. So you map sort of the one sort of emotional reality and put it into a different context to get a different view, different perspective.
And this reminds me a little bit of the brainstorming technique called Scamper, where instead of just randomly getting people to throw ideas up on the whiteboard in a business context or in a boardroom, you would provide some sort of structure to that brainstorming so that they're not just randomly coming up with random stupid ideas. But Scamper stands for, I've forgotten what they all stand for, but I know that the S stands for substitution. So, for instance, you would be which is a classic example of what you've just done. You're taking the farewell to college and you're substituting the situation in the prison that you just kind of described. So, and one of the things that's useful around the Scamper methodology is that you're getting people to substitute A for B, or I think one of the other ones is the M stands for magnifying, so that you're taking something and blowing it out of proportion, or you're minimizing by making it much smaller. Or the R stands for reversing, so you're doing something back to front instead of front to back. The objective of that is simply to get your team members thinking creatively, but again, you're giving them parameters within which to think creatively. I often say to people that if I give you a blank piece of paper and ask you to draw a picture, you won't know what to start. Where to start, what to say, what to draw. But if I give you the same blank piece of paper and I say, I need you to draw a nuclear family, there needs to be a dwelling of some sort, there needs to be a conveyance, and there needs to be four members of the family, then within that, you can draw a castle and a unicorn and a same-sex couple, and everybody's wearing spacesuits, and there's a UFO that comes down as the method of conveyance. But all of that is very creative, but now suddenly I've given you parameters and your imagination can go wild. Sounds as if you're using the gaming structure within the long form improv as a way to keep people on track and inspired at the same time.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because everything that you mentioned so far is like an improv game. You're doing improv games for business people, Ken.
Are we?
Sure.
In fact,
100% are. Yeah,
it's true. We are doing that because often we use the status game as the signal between you and I. When you're working with one of the participants and I'm standing just out of sight, and I might signal higher status, lower status, or I might give you a number of cues of different stereotypes to play, so again, there's structure that we use within the improv. So it's not entirely just random.
Exactly. And almost all improv that you see will start with a suggestion. And what suggestions do is exactly that, give you some sort of parameter to start with, and it also reminds the audience that it's happening in real time. There's a great relationship between improv and failure. If you're too good at it, the audience tunes out because they think it's planned. But failure is really valuable in improv because it's when scenes go off the rails or something happens unexpectedly, it reminds the audience that it's happening now and keeps them present.
In your experience in the business world, because one thing we haven't told our viewers about is the fact that you also, as a day job, work in an administrative capacity. And in that capacity, do you find failure is also valuable?
Of course. Well, this is one of the things when I was facilitating improv for people in other jobs that weren't necessarily thought of as creative, but everyone is essentially creative. You know that. That's one of the things that we practice all the time as improvisers is how to fail. And that's one of the most useful things, I think, that we bring to business people is that there are some situations where I understand you don't want to fail. When you said like nuclear family, I immediately thought of the HBO series Chernobyl because I just finished watching it. So there's a case where like failure's not great. Yes, you learned a lot, but in that those are certainly high stakes situations. But most of the situations that we are in from day to day, we are petrified of failing. And yet failing is the only way that we are able to learn and grow and at a rapid pace. If you don't fail, it takes a really, really long time to get better at what you're doing. So failure in business context is essential. And to be comfortable with that, to be able to take risks. The only way that you're able to take risks in real life or in business is if you have confidence that whatever happens, you're going to figure something out, right? Or you're going to learn something, or it's going to get better. It's going to be a valuable experience. But in our culture, like, we're having sort of a revolution right now where we're bringing these ideas back. I'm seeing a lot of this in business training right now, which is awesome, which is that idea that we should be more comfortable with failure. We can't protect our kids from failure. We shouldn't protect ourselves from failure, right? We have to be bold and go out there and make big choices in order to learn big lessons.
That's a good point, Nicole, because I think one of the things that, you know, you've worked with us on in our, you know, I Need to Effing Talk to You program, and with other actors, is that the idea is to give people the confidence that they can have those difficult workplace conversations, whether it's, you know, manager, employee, whether it's with clients, stakeholders, and practice real time with you, as a simulation that's as close to reality as possible, with a rough outline as to what the conversation's about. And the worst thing that happens, you know, and you've heard me say this to the audience, the worst thing that happens to you is your ego gets bruised. Nothing bad happens. It's a safe environment for you to make mistakes, because actually, if everybody's too good, nobody actually learns a great deal. And if the scenarios go exactly as we maybe have discussed them in advance, then people don't get as much from them. Some of the best sessions I remember doing with you is when the individual examples you've had working with a manager have gone well off at a tangent from what perhaps we would have imagined the conversation went, because you're reacting to things that they're saying, and it's bringing out other really useful learning for them and for other participants. So, you know, the idea that not everything has to be incredibly structured down to the every I dotted, every T crossed, or everything has to be planned out and worked through in advance, allows that freedom for people to grow and to learn something while they're in the moment.
I always say in improv, when we're teaching people improv especially, that what we practice is being comfortable with risk, which means living with uncertainty, and being comfortable with failure and learning from failure. And those are exactly the same kinds of things that I think are really important in business, right? People have to be comfortable with uncertainty, or as much as we can, or at least if we practice being comfortable in uncertainty, then we won't let it hold us back, right? It won't let us hold us back from taking those risks and learning from those experiences that go unexpectedly. And with doing sessions with you, Ken and Russell, also, what's great is, as you say, if there's someone being the manager in the chair, and they might be mortified to go up there, but once they're in there, we do our best to make everyone feel comfortable. And if something, again, goes slightly differently, the reaction from the other people watching is always like one of great support, right? They might laugh, but it's in recognition, because it's like, oh gosh, that's something I might've done or whatever. So being vulnerable is a great opportunity as well. So when those people step in the chair, they are taking a risk by being vulnerable and sitting in that position of uncertainty, but it's something that's really rewarding for everyone else in that room. Someone up there to take the risk, it winds up being sort of a bonding thing, I think, for them as well, right? It's team building as well.
And something that you know, we emphasize, and you've always done really well, is that the joke in any scenario that we run is always on you as the actor. It's never the individual that's made to feel silly. It's something you might respond to something they've done, and there's a comical element to it. But the joke's the people are laughing at something that you've done. They're not laughing at the individual. And there's one particular character that you've played in many different formats for us over the years that I'm thinking, and Ken may be thinking of the same example here. We have a client who had been, I think she attended two of the workshops as a participant, and then brought us in with your good self to work with her team. And I remember before we got into that session, she came over to me while we were having coffee, and she said, "Oh, Nicole, is Nicole going to do the crazy cat lady?" And as I said, yeah, she's going to work it in somehow. She was like, oh, I love this one. I love this one. She went and sat there, was waiting for one of her team to find this scenario where you know, Nicole had had this, I don't remember, it was a difficult member of staff, but somebody who had had this passion for cats. And we left it to you as to what you wanted to, your passion would be and why you couldn't do this particular project away from home. And you'd come up with the cats and this whole story that had the audience believing that it was one of your children until at the end you revealed the fact that it wasn't one of your children that was ill, it was the cat. And they found that quite amusing, yes. And it was, but had been asked to bring back again, can we get the cat lady into yet another scenario? So I think any time that that particular client you work with them, they're going to want you to put that particular a spin on it at some point. So it's always good fun.
You know, ironically, I don't know if the two of you had the same experience that I had, but it was my impression that that third time, the time on request, the scenario actually fell a bit flat for me, and it wasn't as engaging, wasn't as funny, wasn't as spontaneous as it was the first two times. And I think that's an interesting lesson right there, that you can never control the conversation down to its finest points. The conversation goes where the conversation will go. You will ultimately always learn from it. We like to think our participants will always learn from it. But just like real life, the more you try to control the conversation, the less productive it is, the less you and your participant learn from it, and the less constructive it is.
I think I remember from that session, it's because the participant, had nothing to do with me, Ken. It was brilliant. No, I'm just kidding. But the participant was so good. Like, they sort of immediately grasped onto what I was going through, and they were so compassionate and sympathetic, and they made no judgments. So there was like, everyone was like, oh, she's going to freak out. But, you know, it didn't happen because the participant was so deft at handling the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it was back to the point that you can't sort of set up the joke that was never going to have that set up line to deliver. So, and again, it was back to the fact that we can't rehearse these, we don't rehearse these sessions so that they're, you know, down to certain things happening at certain points. But I think it is that point that was useful for participants to know that no matter how much they prepared for an appraisal or a difficult conversation or a disciplinary interview, they were never 100% sure exactly what was going to be able to come up. And it was their ability to be able to, you know, improvise. That's what we've been talking about. And having the confidence to be able to do that and do it well, which is one of the things that we work with them on. So let's have a little change. So Ken, there was something you wanted to add in.
No, I think we're going the same place, Russell. Speaking of preparing and preparation, I think we've created a list of questions that we wanted, rapid-fire questions we wanted to give to Nicole. And I wondered if you wanted to take those through us, take Nicole through those and see if you can surprise her with a few left curves.
Absolutely. Well, we were, great minds think alike, Ken. I was just moving into that point. So we'll say quick fire, although when we did this last time, they weren't quite so quick. So we'll just say there'll be some questions. So Nicole, for you, our favorite movie and why?
Oh, I have so many. They're so good. But I thought of one that you might not expect from me is I have a dear soft spot for a movie called Killing Me Softly with Joseph Fiennes and Heather Graham. It was made, I think, in the 1990s, and it was directed by a very, very prominent Chinese director. And when I describe it to people, like I've described it before, as it's kind of a romantic, it's a bit of a romantic comedy. And someone stopped me and was like, no, Nicole, it's a thriller. He's a stalker. I know, but she's got this great job in a design firm in England, and he's just really intense, and they have some misunderstandings. No. He was stalking her. I'm like, no, he just loves her a lot. Anyway. It's I just have a soft spot for Josephine, so it's very hard for me to not defend him. He's great.
You chose not to pick Joseph Fiennes in Shakespeare in Love, but you chose to pick Joseph Fiennes in this creepy stalker movie.
I had a fantasy for a long time that I would meet Joseph Fiennes in a buffet line when I went to. Ken, when I went to our mutual friend who's now famous, I went to her wedding in LA. And before I went, I was like, oh, what if Joseph Fiennes is there? I don't know why he would be, but maybe he'll be in the buffet line, as if there'd be a buffet. It was a very ritzy wedding. Anyway, and you know, I would say, oh, Mr. Fiennes, Joseph, I'm one of your biggest fans. I really loved your work in that movie. What was it called again? And then I would sort of prompt him, you know, what was it called? And he'd be like, oh, yeah, so Shakespeare in Love. And I'm like, no, not that one. And he'd go like, oh. And then he'd go like through a list of his major accomplishments. And I'd be like, no. And then finally I'd be like, Killing Me Softly, which is a very, again, it's kind of a soft porn thriller. It's very cheesy. And then he would laugh and he would go, wow, this woman is not like the models that I've dated before. She is smart and funny. I like her. I'm going to whisk her off to England. And then we'd get married and we'd live in an apartment in New York and I'd produce really bad shows for him. I would write really bad plays for him because love means that you don't take risks, right? So anyway, I had a whole...
I see how, as an improv artist, you've laid out every little pearl on the string here.
But guess what? It didn't happen that way, did it? So I had to be ready for anything. Instead, I wound up taking a bus for like 2.5 hours from Venice Beach to a house in the Hollywood Hills from the hostel I was staying at because I couldn't afford to get any closer.
We should just leave that for listeners there. So they're left wondering whether you took the bus with Joseph Fiennes. He was with you. And he didn't actually met you at the bus station, not at the buffet bar. So we'll leave it to people's imaginations. They can write in, they can put in the comments below how they think that story ended. So there are thoughts on there.
I guarantee you they'll never guess the right one.
We'll never guess the right one. Okay, so do you have a favorite? Well, apart from this particular actor that you've been talking about, do you have a favorite actor or improviser, and why are they your favorite?
You know what? There's an actress improviser named Patty Stiles who's originally from Edmonton, and I think she moved to Australia with a bunch of other people. Anyway, but Patty Stiles, originally from Edmonton, and she is my favorite improviser of all time. She is incredible, and the reason is. There's like one of the golden rules in improv is make the other person look good. She is the most generous actress I've ever seen on stage and that I've worked with personally. She's incredible because she's so skilled, but everything that she does is always to bring out the best in the other person on stage that she's on stage with. So I really, really admire her spirit of generosity as well as her like sheer talent, but she's like completely egoless. She serves the story and she serves the other people in the scene with her. And I really admire that.
Well, there's another leadership lesson for business leaders is that your job as a leader is to bring out the best in others, to bring out the talent in others, is to make others look good, not necessarily to make yourself look good. As you indicated, Nicole, you know, an improv scene falls flat when you're trying to make yourself look good.
That's right. You have two people trying to make themselves look good. It gets really competitive and they wind up undercutting each other and telling a bunch of jokes and not telling a story. But if you have two people on stage, each trying to make the other one look great, something magical always happens. And I find, yeah, exactly. That's a great lesson for business, for leadership, and also in like relationships too, right? If you have two people trying to make the other person look good, it's always going to be a win-win.
And there might be a little sort of subset on there about how... lessons in leadership, but also perhaps relationship advice. I think those listening are getting like 3-for-1 on this particular episode. 3-for-1 here.
I wanted to ask Nicole if your what's your favorite improv game? Because you mentioned how games are often embedded in improv scenes. What's your favorite form of improv or improv game?
Well, again, when they happen within scenes, it's sort of a slightly different, obviously, goal and context. But if I'm like working with a group of people. One of my favorite games is one that I invented, which is there's like a trillion versions of each improv game. So I didn't really invent it. It's probably just a combination of a bunch of different things, but I call it Thank You. And what happens is you have two people and you can do it in a circle or whatever. And you have one person is going to return something to the other person and they definitely own whatever it is. And so the first thing that the person A does is say, hey, I found this. Outside or whatever. And I think it's yours. And they give it back to them. The second person says, thank you. That's the first thing they say. Thank you. Then the person A asks them a series of questions about the object, which now becomes something. Oh, well, Ken, I always wanted to ask you, why do you have that disco Furby? You know, like whatever it is. And then they have to come up with a response. And so over the course of the game, there's a couple of things that it stresses. The reason why I like it is because it incorporates so many So many improv rules. One is, again, try to make the other person look good. Ask open-ended questions. Stay curious. Stay in the moment. Don't have an agenda. Go with the flow. And again, that spirit of gratitude, because the first thing that the person says when they get the thing back is thank you. The actor doesn't know what it is yet. But the rules of the game are you have to say thank you. And that winds up starting the scene on a positive note. So that's another big improv rule that we have is start positive. Things are always going to go squirrely. They're going to go somewhere weird and strange generally. But if you start with a degree of being positive, again, you have room to grow. And it gives it starts a great platform of normalcy for the game to shoot out from. So I like that game. And it's always funny. I play this with business people all the time. And people don't think they're creative until you put them in these situations. And then suddenly they discover how creative they are and their friends are. And they have a wonderful time. So that's when I work with business people, one of the things I love is that there's always someone who comes up to me at the end of the session and says, you know, when I heard this was going to be improv, I like cringed. I thought this was going to be terrible. We were going to be put on the spot to tell jokes and whatnot. And instead we just played a bunch of games that increase our ability to listen and share with each other and have fun together. So that's always a good time.
The thank you is a really valuable lesson. Russell and I were talking 2 weeks ago in the Bad Boss Stories about appraisal reviews. And one of the ways to handle and learn to accept feedback in an appraisal review is to say thank you. Mm-hmm. And I've often done those kinds of exercises with people where you can say only two things. You can say either thank you, mm-hmm. or you can say thank you, tell me more. Mm-hmm. And so if it's negative feedback, you can say thank you, tell me more about that, mm-hmm. so that I can more fully understand what it is that you're giving me. And it really leads to a different way of receiving feedback, but it also leads to a different way of giving feedback, mm-hmm. when you have to not just justify or just like lay blame, but now suddenly you have to start helping the person understand, mm-hmm. and helping the person move to a new place with their understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Exactly. It's very valuable, Ken.
Well, I love the way you're talking about that curiosity, because one of the, mm-hmm. Phrases I always like is you never want to be the brightest person in the room. And if you are the brightest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. You know, there's always that idea. There are other people around you who have interesting things to say, a different perspective on it, a different take. And it's a good way to, you know, be curious and get people to tell you about that. And then we can draw out some of their experiences and, mm-hmm. and they can build on ours. And guess what? And then we're all building one upon each other. And suddenly we've collaborated into something that's the sum is greater than the individual parts. And I think the work that you're talking about there is a good example of doing that. Mm-hmm. So if we were looking there, Barry, because it's fascinating, and I've always been not coming, and like the two of you, not coming from an acting, a theatre, an arts background, I've always been very interested to hear of yourself and other actors talk about their trade and what goes into it. So what would you say was the biggest challenge as either an actor or an improviser that you feel that you face?
You know what? Self-criticism is always a big one, right? As an actor, every time I submit an audition, and I'm not the only one, I'm sure every time you submit an audition, first thing you think is like, oh, I should have done this differently. What should I have done? So there's that sort of self-judgment that you have to learn to live with and let go of. I had the same experience, and in improv, it happens all the time too, right? Because you leave the stage and you're like, you know what I should have done? Oh, you know what would have been better? And you have to sort of live with that, right? It happens in the moment. You have to let it go because you're never going to be able to recreate that moment. So you just have to take whatever lesson you can from it and carry that on. And I remember having this experience with a younger improviser backstage after a show. And she was like, so Nicole, like, how do you do it? Like, at what point do you get to where you finally stop judging yourself after you leave the stage? And I said, you don't, you don't, it's always going to be with you. But again, it's a practice of learning how to, again, recognize it and let it go. It's very much, there's so much in improv that I also find is in parallel with exercises in mindfulness. Like I think of it as a meditation, right? In meditation, are you ever going to have a completely blank mind without thoughts crisscrossing? No, it's just the practice of learning how to respond to those thoughts and say thank you and let them go their way. And you're always going to be striving towards that state, but you probably never get there. It's about the journey. And so same thing in improv and judging. And I think in lots of aspects of our lives too, right? There's so many opportunities we have to judge ourselves. And the practice is just to learn how to be comfortable with the choices that we made and learn from them and let it go and let go of those judgments. Another thing I love about improv is it's really about staying in the moment. If you're on stage and you're thinking about what you just said, then you're not listening to the other person and you've lost the thread of the scene and things go south. If you're standing there talking to the other person and you're thinking ahead about, oh, I got this great joke, I want to tell this later. Again, it's not going to happen the way that you think it will and it will fall flat. You have to really just release the past and release the future and just stay in the moment, stay present and listen. Number one thing we teach is listening.
I like your metaphor. You have to let go of the present, which is also equally true. You have to let go of wanting to control what's happening in this moment.
Oh, yes. Yes. Mm. Yes. Yeah. You have to listen to what the scene wants and forget about your agenda and just, follow the action of the scene. And you can always bring things in to help sort of shift things one way or the other, but you can't have an agenda that is so rigid. It can't open up and be open to discovery, right? When things go not in the way that you expect, those are the great moments of discovery. That's when genius happens.
And that's interesting, those sort of parallel. I remember reminding me of hearing an interview with Bo Levi Mitchell, who's the quarterback with the Calgary Stampeders. And he was asked, what did he say was one of the, key attributes of a quarterback? And he said, having a short memory. And I think it was led to your point in there that if you've just made a bad play, the last thing you want to do is spend the time on the sideline for the next however minutes going over and over in your mind about what you did wrong. All you can do is get into the next play. And it's a bit like you're talking about mm-hmm. there in improv. It might not have gone quite as well. It wasn't quite the joke didn't land as well. But if I spend too much time dwelling on that, the next opportunities come up, the next piece is coming along, and I'm missing that because mm-hmm. I'm still now thinking about something else. And again, I suppose that's mm-hmm. a good lesson for our leaders listening here, that mm-hmm. being in the moment and listening and being able to let things go and accept things aren't always going to be perfect. So doesn't mean we want to strive to be better, even better, but sometimes you just want to let it go and move on to the next opportunity and mm-hmm. take that opportunity. Don't miss that because you're still talking about what would have happened 5 minutes ago, a week ago, a month ago, whatever.
For sure. And I know it's happened in sessions with you and Ken too, with the managers in the chair, where if someone has a really rigid agenda, they just get stuck almost immediately. They freeze immediately and call for a lifeline because it's like, it's not going the way that I thought it would. And then they're at a loss. Whereas the people that are just open to being flexible and listening, often, perform the best because they're willing to sort of go with what comes out. They've let go of their agenda and because new things will come into the conversation that they couldn't expect because they don't live in the other person's head, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I suppose that's the difference, I suppose, between you improvising a scene like you do with us and you enacting out a scripted, predetermined conversation where you mm-hmm. already know what the other person's going to say because you've rehearsed it, six times and you know that's what's coming next. And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the interesting points that comes out from there, that people aren't going to have that. It's not predetermined. Whatever you've written down on your piece of paper that this is how the conversation is going to go and these are the things I want to talk about, that you know that once we get into the conversation, just as it's the same as when you get on to on stage, that it can change. And it's mm-hmm. about not holding it too rigidly and being able to move on and take the opportunity and listen to what's being said and not thinking, I thought they're going to say X. They haven't mm-hmm. said X. Why have they not said X? And again, you've experienced that with some of our participants who are holding mm-hmm. on, as you say, rigidly. And they're like, but she hasn't said this. They said, well, that's because that's what you thought she was going to say. It's not what she was actually going to say. So, there's some moments lost there. Well, that's great. That's great, Nicole. So, can the Just we want to go another a question that Ken and I were thinking about on here was based on the you know the work that we've done. You've worked with us for many of these now. I'm not sure how many you've done, but it's a lot, a lot of them. How have you used your experience with improv when you're having those difficult conversations in your own life, you know, work or personal or acting wise? How have you used that knowledge of improv to help you be better at having those difficult conversations?
I think it relates back to what we were just talking about, which is just to be, you know, start in a position of positivity, start in a position of gratitude, and be able to move your agenda if necessary, to set your agenda aside if it's necessary, to be able to stay present, and to know that it's okay if it's uncomfortable, but you'll get through it, right? To be able to be comfortable in a position of discomfort and know that something positive is going to come out of it.
I like that thought there about being comfortable in a position of discomfort. And I think that's, again, it's that back to what I said to people, you know, the worst thing that happens here is your ego is going to get bruised. you know, it's not going to last forever, is it? They're going to feel uncomfortable for a little bit of the time. And we have, when we've had those sort of our conversations ourselves with people, you feel uncomfortable for a bit of time. But if you know you're trusting the process, you're able to find that you can come up to a successful resolution in the end. It might not just be as comfortable as you thought or would be mapped out in the way that you expected it to be. So that's good thoughts.
Yeah.
It also ties to your metaphor around meditation that you alluded to earlier, Nicole. One of the things that meditation often teaches is something very similar, getting comfortable with failure, but also getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. The act of meditating is rarely comfortable for anyone. You're sitting cross-legged. We in the West aren't perhaps used to that because we sit in chairs rather than on cushions on the ground. But even still, just if you're trying to meditate for any longer than 20 or 30 minutes, your body starts to cramp up. And so just getting comfortable with just sitting with that discomfort rather than trying to change it is one of the pieces of meditation. And it's also one of the pieces that we try to teach in these uncomfortable conversations is just knowing that it's going to be uncomfortable, practicing in our workshops with these improv artists. And so that you're comfortable with that discomfort so that you no longer dread it when it comes time to have those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Something else that sort of overlaps, I think you just reminded me, is that, even that when we do certain narrative forms of improv, so again, the musical is a narrative form or Shakespeare is a narrative form. It just means that the story comes out of a suggestion from the audience, but we have practice a certain type of structure in order to help us have something to sort of hang on to and come back to. So you, as you were saying, you have to have a plan and just be prepared to be flexible with that plan or let it go when it's not serving you. But yeah, we, as improvisers, we rehearse a ton for something that we make up on the spot, right? There's a ton of preparation and there's like a ton of, for something that's like about being spontaneous, there are a ton of rules that are just designed to help us be our best selves out there.
And again, that sort of echoes with the approach that we are talking about with our managers when you're working with us, that, you know, the preparation piece is key. It doesn't mean don't be prepared. In fact, the better prepared you are, and some of the thing that we're doing with you is preparing people, then you're more able to deal with living in the moment because you've rehearsed and you've practiced and you've thought through what some of the implications could be of what you're going to do and what some of the reactions might be. So, you know, that seems to be key that don't give people the idea that it's like we're just sort of doing it off the, what was the phrase that my father used to use, you know, off the back of a cigarette packet. You know, we just put three words on a piece of paper and we just went with it. You know, there was a little bit more to it in terms of preparation so that you could actually be comfortable with improvising because you had prepared beforehand so you knew what you were doing.
Which that also brings up another point about what I love about what you do with people, Ken and Russell, is that, again, this is an opportunity for them to practice before being with a real person, right? Before you have that difficult conversation with someone in your workplace that you are dreading and you don't know how to prepare for, you know, practice and make all your mistakes and all your big risks with us where it's safe. And that's part of your planning is I've practiced being uncomfortable in this situation and trying these tactics until I can have them at my disposal in the future when I really need them, when the stakes really are higher.
That is a great point and something that we emphasize a bit. It's the only chance that you can, closest to reality you can have without it being reality. Well, and so why not? So, it's been great talking to you, Nicole. We've had some wonderful insights into the work that you do. What I'd like is you to leave us with is there one or two final nuggets that you'd like to leave with our listeners here, where the lessons that you feel that as leaders that we can learn from that theatre, improv, film, TV world that you are so immersed in and have worked in so well for many years. So if there was anything you were going to leave us as a parting thought, what would they be?
Oh, I would reiterate that in order to take that risks are really, really important. And to be able to take risks, you have to be comfortable with uncertainty and to profit from failure and to be willing to do those, willing to be in those moments. As a leader, I think, again, so many things from improv cross over into leadership, which is some of those things that we emphasized before as well. Starting in a position of gratitude, start your interactions positively with people. What was the other thing? Make the other person look good, right? Listen. And number one is always listen, like truly listen. And that's going to give you a great insight as to where the next profitable step is going to be in your conversation. And as a leader, yeah, if you can listen more than talk, if you can ask questions and stay curious, that's, again, it's going to be highly profitable for your interaction. I use that word profitable too much.
Well, I'd say one of the old adages is you've got two ears and one mouth and you should use them in that order, really. Okay, so Nicole, thank you so much for spending time with us today. That's been wonderful. I'm sure that our listeners have enjoyed your insights into the work that you do and how it crosses over into the business world.
Sure.
Opportunity, is there anything that you're doing? Have you got any upcoming events that are running that you would like to tell our listeners about? And then we can throw that into the show notes and so that they can see you in action.
For sure. Can I just add one more thing to like the value that of what you do with people that I think it's good for other people to remember to be in this situation? Because sometimes sometimes when companies want to run these sort of programs and they want to just sort of practice with each other, it's like, oh, we're just going to get the staff to be in scenarios with each other. Sure, we understand it's important to practice things, but we're going to get them to do it just with their other colleagues. The benefit that we as actors and improvisers bring is that you don't know us when you sit in the chair, so you're not going to have the same kind of attitude, right? When you say it's the closest thing to real thing, to real other than the real thing, like it is, because we as actors and improvisers are real people. We are real people, and our reactions to how you speak to us are genuine. And the benefit of us is that one of the other things that actors train on is being able to maintain multiple points of focus. So we're able to listen to what you're saying and also regard how we feel about that and hold that into our head and also be able, with your help, to sort of challenge people in the chair at the level that is appropriate for them. So the benefit that people get from doing programs like yours is that they will get that experience and they also have the benefit of receiving feedback from their, whatever we are to them, their staff perhaps, or their customers, that they will never get in real life, because real people will hold that feedback back, or they may not know why they felt really gross about that interaction, or they may not know why they felt really great about that interaction. But we, as these sort of hybrid improvisers, are able to bring that benefit to people. And we will tell you what you did that made us feel great and what you did that made us react in the way that we did. And it's all useful gold nuggets of information. So I really appreciate the work that you do with businesses. I'm not doing much, to be honest, because it's a pandemic. So we're almost out. We're almost out. But I haven't improvised in like 14 months. We haven't. Our stages have been shut down. But I've been producing more music lately. So you can always check out something called Canadian Famous, because that's me. I'm kind of middling. I'm really more Calgary famous than Canadian famous. But that idea that you've probably recognized me from a commercial, but you just don't remember where. But I've been producing music lately. So again, you can look up Canadian Famous on the internet and you might find something about me.
Excellent. We'll put that into the show notes and also the work you do with the Kinkanauts. So when we finally come out of our basements, people will have somewhere to go and they can go and see some live improv with your good self and some of your colleagues.
We do have a reemergence plan, so we will be coming back at some point. So yes, check www.kinkanauts.com. It's like astronaut, but kinkonaut.com. Kinkanauts.com for info on hopefully upcoming shows sometime soon.
And if you can't wait until the pandemic is over to be able to see Nicole improvising, then you can always book one of the I Need to Effing Talk to You workshops with Nicole, and she'll do it on Zoom with you and your staff. And I got to say, Nicole, you've done some great work on Zoom with some of our clients. It's been a joy to watch.
Thank you. Yes.
You'll also find Nicole as one of the actors in our soon-to-be-launched online course, the I Need to Effing Talk to You Fundamentals course. It stars both Nicole Zylstra and Peter Strand Rumpel, who we spoke with in an earlier podcast. You can see both of them in action. I think, Nicole, you do a marvelous turn as Marilyn the manager in that particular series.
Oh, yes. Marilyn the maleficent manager.
Thanks very much for listening to the I Need to Effing Talk to You podcast today. I've been your host, Ken Cameron, along with Russell Stratton. We've been here with Nicole Zylstra. If you're interested in more of our podcasts, be sure to subscribe on your podcast provider of choice. Just look for I Need to F-ING Talk to You on your favorite podcast provider of choice. If you want to find out more about what we're up to, go to ineedtof-ingtalktoyou.com. You'll find a lot of different resources on how to have these conversations, including our book, there on that website.
Okay, thanks very much, everybody. Thanks again, Nicole, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.